Tonight is going to be the second talk in this series I'm giving. I'm giving a talk on the three refuges. So last time I spoke about the three refuges in general, this act of going for refuge, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which is really this, it's a practice that you find in almost all schools of Buddhism. And so the last talk I gave, I talked about the three refuges in general. And then I spoke about the first refuge, taking refuge in the Buddha. And just a few things that I covered last time was you know, some of the qualities of taking refuge in the Buddha, finding shelter or finding inspiration from that is one is that I spoke about is just taking refuge in our own ability to wake up. You know, all of us have this ability to wake up, and it's gaining confidence in that. And really seeing that all of us here tonight have this ability to wake up on some level. And the other important point that I spoke about last time was also taking refuge in the Buddha in terms of, you know, Buddha literally means, you know, the one who is awake. So it's really taking refuge in wakefulness and awareness, which we're really doing a lot in the meditation. And then when we bring that meditation into our daily lives, is really resting in that, in awareness or wakefulness. So on to the next refuge. So tonight I'm going to be speaking about taking refuge in the Dharma. And there's as you know, like my talk last time, there's all these different levels that we can take refuge in the Dharma in, and all these different dimensions to it. And the way I want to speak about it tonight is actually taking refuge in the Dharma in terms of following a path, this act of actually following, and talking about it in terms of that, as a way of coming to understand what this really means or giving you a sense of what that might mean to you. And I want to start with a poem about following a path. It's about a journey. And actually, that's the name of it, The Journey. And it's by Mary Oliver. So she begins, "One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough in a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save." I find that a really striking description of a journey. Right? And do you remember how she started this poem? I'm really struck how she started this poem, too. One day you finally knew one day what you had to do, and then you began. So this is where she's beginning, right? And then we hear this again. She comes back to this phrase again. You know, you knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations. Even in the midst of that, you knew what you had to do, and you began. You began on this journey. And then it changes at the end, right? Determined to do the only thing you could do. Determined to save the only life you could save. So tonight I want to speak about taking refuge in the Dharma, really following the Dharma. I'm going to be speaking about this quality of following the Dharma, but also in terms of getting a sense of this, you know what you have to do, this deep inner sense. This deep inner sense that can lead you forward. And I'm sure many of you have had this feeling of this deep inner sense at times in your life, right? That feeling of you know what you have to do. And sometimes it sometimes feels like it's something more than you and something that you can actually follow. And you might even get the sense when you have that deep gut feeling that, that has that quality of following that, right? And it's different than those other voices. You know, these other voices that she was talking about, right? She says, you know what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Has anyone ever heard those bad voices, advices shouting their bad advice in your mind? It's those voices that really think they know what to do, right? It's just that there's not a lot of wisdom on that level. And you might have noticed how many times we're believing those voices. And this is different. It's sensing into something deeper. So, yeah, following the Dharma, sensing into something deeper. So, on the surface level, you know, taking refuge in the Dharma, the first way it's usually talked about is taking refuge in the teachings. In these teachings from this 2,500-year-old tradition. It's amazing. Huh? This practice has been going on for 2,500 years. This really rich tradition. And in this tradition, of course, we have many, many teachings. And especially, I think, a lot of times, here, a lot of times what's emphasized are some of those early discourses that can be so powerful in terms of explaining this path. So it's learning about these teachings. It's learning about this tradition. And I think a lot of times, and maybe this is for some of you, a lot of times we explore these traditions because we're looking for, you know, the possibility or seeing the possibility of walking in the world in a different way. Of relating to our experience in a different way. That's what this is about, right? And from that, what comes from that is this possibility of this path of awakening, of really of awakening. But of course it doesn't stop there, just at that level. There's these other levels too. Taking refuge in teachings really doesn't amount to much. You know what I mean? You can read a lot of books. Have you noticed you can read a lot of books and your life doesn't change very much? Anyone ever tried that before? Yeah. So there's got to be a little more depth to this. So it's not only doing some reading, it's putting this into practice. It's doing what, for example, what we're doing here tonight, putting in the time to meditate. To not only learn about this, but to actually do it. Then that's a deeper taking refuge. You know, so this is not simply, you know, a teaching about liberation. This is about a process that leads to a liberation. This is what it's about. And it's about engaging in that process. So on this level, we're coming to follow the teachings by doing the practice. We learn about the teachings and then we put those into practice. So now we have an even deeper level. So we're coming to actualize these teachings. And I want to spend a little bit of time about this actualizing these teachings and actually the dynamic around here because I think it's interesting. And in particular, many of the times we have this sense that the teachings are somehow outside of us. They're out there. And then we read them, and then we try to follow them in some way. But I think if we were to really closely look at this dynamic, it's really this interface between a practitioner and the tradition. Or maybe it's an interface or an interchange between a group of people and the tradition. So it's a dynamic It's not something dead. There's this dynamic. There's this relationship that's going on. And that's really what's going on when we begin to practice, is we're interacting, you could say, with this tradition on some level. And I think when we engage in the practice in that way, that's when the tradition comes alive. And it's important to realize that a tradition is not something that has happened and static and then we follow it. A tradition is something that's alive and always changing. And we really see this in Buddhism. Buddhism's fascinating. We have this 2,500 year history. And the practice has actually changed each time it's moved into a different culture. And that's going to be inevitable. Even if you take one school of Buddhism, like Theravada, it's amazing the changes that it's gone through. And thank God, right? Not because it was somehow bad back then, but so that it speaks to us, that it really speaks to our heart. That it can meet us where we're at and lead us to liberation. And for it to do that, the tradition needs to be alive. It is alive. It's inevitable. There's no way a tradition can stay still, right? It also is impermanent. It changes. So going back to the poem, this poem, you knew what you had to do. We have this almost this different flavor to this. It's not, I knew what I had to do. In this practice, it's almost, again, this dynamic of learning about the practice, engaging in this practice, and having it inform this deeper sense that we can come from. And then we move from that deeper place that knows in a different way, knows what we have to do. And then it continues to get informed by this tradition, by this practice. So that in itself is a dynamic. And so it's this dynamic of following the Dharma in that manner. Is this making sense? Now this is alive in this sense. And so we almost reach deeper places, you could say ourselves or maybe something greater than ourselves, that we can move forward with when we practice, because our practice is informing that. And I think when we start to study a tradition or practice a tradition, what I find so wonderful about it is that then I can move from a place that's not limited by just my understanding, my ideas, but it's being influenced by this 2,500 year tradition. I think there's something very moving about that. Being moved by a path of awakening. Because that's much bigger than me. So it's this dance. And I don't think we're going to get to this, but I think an important question to ask, each one of us has to ask, is what is our relationship to this tradition, to this 2,500 year tradition? It's going to be different for each person, right? Some people, I'm just interested in meditation. I'm not really interested in any of the Buddhist teachings and things like that. And it's the meditation that I'm really interested in. And so it's that kind of relationship maybe to the tradition, just to this specific practice. And I want to point out, there's nothing wrong with that. What's important is to see what fits for you, right? Or maybe for others, there's a certain aspect of the tradition that you really feel drawn to, and that's what informs you. And to others, it might be another aspect. Or for some of you, it might be a number of traditions that you're lying upon, resting upon for your practice. I think it's important, though, to investigate that. What is your relationship to the tradition? It's an interesting question, and it can give us more of a sense of what direction we need to go in. And I think it's also kind of interesting in terms of a group. You know, here Buddhism is coming to America and it's this new thing, this new practice. And I think, again, that's where this question needs to be held, is what is our relationship to this tradition? So now I want to offer you a few more reflections on following the Dharma, this understanding taking refuge in the Dharma in terms of following. this feel of following. And I want to share with you, I want to use a little bit this interchange that happened between a Zen student or a Zen monk and his teacher. And I just want to point out, you know, I'm not going to be going into great depth into this interchange, but this isn't an interchange between a beginner and a teacher. This is a student that had quite a bit of depth to his practice. Actually, the student in this interchange, his name was Joshu. His teacher's name was Nansen. And Joshu was quite a interesting practitioner. So he got ordained when he was in his teens. And then at the age of 18, he had this really quite profound spiritual awakening. This awakening that happened when he was 18. And from that time on, he actually practiced a number of years in order to deepen that, to let go of even more of the things that were shackling him down, to have a deeper liberation. So from 18 to, it was either to the age of 50 or 60, he practiced mostly under his teacher, Nansen. And so this interchange probably happened when he was maybe in his 40s or 50s. So he has some practice behind him. Yeah. And then when he was 50, he's an incredible practitioner. Then when he's 50 or 60, he decides, I need to go on pilgrimage to really deepen my practice more. So at the age of 50 or 60, he went on a 20-year pilgrimage around China. And then after 20 years on pilgrimage, he thought, I think I'm going to begin to teach. So at the age of 80, he began to teach. And he was supposed to be this exquisite teacher of really knowing how to help his students. And then he taught for the next 40 years, and he died at 120. So it's really this amazing life. May we all practice until 120. It's just begun. So here's this interchange. So Joshu asks Nansen, what is the way? What is the way? He's asking this on two different levels. What is the way? Of course, Buddhism has now come into China, so the way being the word Tao. What is the Tao? So what is the way in terms of the profound way? But also, what is the way in my daily life? How do I do this in order to get to the way? And Nansen replies, ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind is the way. So I want to say a few things about just this reply right here. On one level, one way of understanding ordinary mind is the way a lot of times this is taught is that just the ordinary things of our life are the things that lead us on this way, that lead us to the way. When we pay attention to the simple things in our life. Right? Like just when you're meditating, paying attention to the feeling of the breathing, to a sound coming and going. These ordinary things are the way. Actually, a monk once asked his Zen master, he had just come to the monastery, and he said, please point me to the entry of these teachings. And the Zen master said, do you hear the sound of the stream? And the monk said, yes. And the Zen master said, enter there. Just with hearing, the activity of hearing. So the gateway to this practice is paying attention to the ordinary things that are happening moment after moment. So in this sense, we're getting kind of a deeper understanding of what the Dharma is. It's not only the teachings of the practice, but now I'm saying that on a deeper level, the Dharma, a lot of times the way it's translated is as truth, or maybe more precisely, the way things are. That's what we're beginning to take refuge in. That the Dharma, in some ways, is all around us in that sense. So taking refuge in the way things are. There was a Chinese poet by the name of Su Tung Po who had this awakening, and he wrote a poem about it. And he said, the sounds of the valley streams are his long, broad tongue. The forms of his mountains are his pure body. At night I heard the myriad sutra verses uttered. How can I relate to others what they say? you hear the direction he's pointing in with this poem? That on some level, everything around us is kind of metaphorically speaking the Dharma, right? Is calling us to awaken. When we apply the practice, everything is teaching us. You know? So nothing is outside the Dharma. You know, a lot of times, lay life is, sometimes people worry, oh, maybe I should become a monastic because that's where really the Dharma is. But actually, nothing's outside the Dharma. Zen Master Dogen speaks to this. He says, those who see worldly life as an obstacle to Dharma see no Dharma in everyday actions. They have not yet discovered that there are no everyday actions outside of Dharma. There's nothing outside of the way things are. But I want to be really important about how I mean this. So I'm not saying that, you know, we're trying to meditate so we get to the point where we see a mountain and then we see it emanate as the Buddha. We're not looking for some kind of visual spiritual experience in that sense. It's more seeing the nature of moment-to-moment experience, right? It's not so much what's out there, seeing what's out there. It's recognizing what's the relationship to out there. What's the process of that moment of experience? What happens when you see a mountain? What's the dynamic there? So this is really important. It's becoming curious about our experience and our relationship to that experience. Not to all the objects out there. Because we can travel around the world and see all different kinds of wonderful, great things. That can be very uplifting, but that's not going to wake us up. So when I say that everything out there is calling us to awaken, what I mean by that is what we need to bring to that is our practice. When we have our practice there, then we can notice the way things are with whatever's arising. So again, we're not looking for some kind of, you know, visual experience out there. Is this making sense? Where we want our attention? Just asking, what is this? What is this going on right now? Not so much seeing that person. Of course, that's part of it, but what's that activity of that experience? What's going on? Like some of the things you might... A lot of times it's just the details, right? Oh, this is a pleasant experience. Oh, it's really unpleasant. It's kind of neutral. Ah, and there's really some liking this experience or not liking this experience. And then what happens to all that? Oh, it fades away. And then something else arises up. So the details of our experience of that. And having that relationship, then we live in a world that's calling us to awaken. And it's just the things that are going on right now. The way things are right now. I remember I was doing a longer retreat with this Burmese teacher, the Venerable Sayadaw Upandita. And I was gung-ho. You know, it's enlightenment or bust. So, you know, and he has a way of really pushing that energy, you know. So I was working really hard. And in that tradition of practice, a lot of times what you do is you go into the teacher and you report about your experience in your meditation. Just these details like I was describing, but in fine detail. And I came in with what I thought was a pretty good report. You know, it was precise and stuff like that. And he said, you're looking for something. Stop looking for something. It was really great advice. It was like there was so much effort that I was missing what was going on. It was just what was right in front of me is what it needed my attention. Just that. So just seeing the way things are. And again, it has that quality of following, right? It's not like I'm trying to find it. I'm following experience and noticing what's arising and passing away with experience moment after moment. That has a different feel to it, right? So to stop looking for something in that way. Yeah. In a lot of ways, I think it's really important, especially for a meditation practice, to remember that all we need to do is be with the way things are right now. You know? A lot of times we'll have this concept that meditation should be a certain way. It should be calm and tranquil. So then when we're feeling anxious, when there's some anxiety there or something, oh, I shouldn't be with this. I want to get to the good stuff. But that's the way things are. And what's it like to not only be with it, but take refuge in that? What a radically different idea about taking refuge, right? A lot of times when we hear this taking refuge, it has this kind of sweet sound to it, which it is. But can we find that sweetness in whatever's arising? To know that that can lead to our liberation, that can lead to a different kind of relationship to our experience when we just simply take refuge in what's going on right now. And what I mean by taking refuge in what's going on right now is simply being with it, seeing it. Seeing it for what it is, feeling it. There's anxiety there. Oh, there's tightness. Oh, the tightness increases, then it decreases, and then it fades away. Simply just witnessing that. That's taking refuge in the way things are right now. Yeah. Really simple. So simple that we always complicate it. It's really simple. So on another level, taking refuge in the Dharma is taking refuge in the way things are. And that in and of itself can be incredibly profound. So I want to get back to this story because I haven't finished it, between Joshua and Nansen. So Joshua asks, what is the way? And Nansen says, ordinary mind is the way. And hopefully now we have a sense more of ordinary mind, of ordinary things, being with ordinary things, being with the way things are. That's what Nansen's saying is the way. So that's the way. And then Joshua, maybe being in a state similar to mine, says, shall I try to seek after it? Joshua asks. And Nansen replies, he says, if you try for it, you'll become separated from it. You're going to miss it. Just similarly what I was talking about with Sayadaw Upendita. If we're looking for something, we're going to miss what's going on right now. And then Joshua, he persists. He says, how can I know the way unless I try for it? And I think Nansen is really getting a sense of what's going on underneath this question. So he says, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. So the way is not a matter, it's not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is confusion. I want to stop there again. So it's not a matter of knowing. It's not a matter of not knowing. First, it's not a matter of knowing. I think this is particularly important for us. I think, you know, especially in this age of information, it's so amazing. Isn't it amazing how we can find out about something, get some knowledge about something, some information about something so quickly? Just Google it. And there it is. There's your answer. And it's so easy. It's so easy. I think that we've become kind of enamored with information. So if we don't understand something, then we can just go to the internet and figure it out. It's so easy. And so I feel like there's almost this information dependence that's now leaking into our society. There's wonderful things about, you know, the internet. I'm not saying that. It's important to see this other aspect. And also, I think this happens a lot just with this practice, is that there can be this tendency to want to know all about it. I really want to know everything about meditation. I want to know how it works, and I want to know why we're doing it. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And when we get into that, I think what happens is then there can be this frozen quality, right? And we're no longer doing the practice. We're lost in trying to know it. And not do the practice with simply being with our experience, the direct experience of it. So in essence, this is not a matter of knowing. We come to the teachings to get more of a sense of how to practice, but it's not this kind of knowing. Even in Mary Oliver's poem, you know that you know you knew what you had to do. That's not an intellectual knowing. That's something that comes from your gut. Something similar to this, to that, I think, to what she's talking about. But I'm sure all of you know that kind of knowing, right? Again, you sense it. So this practice is not a matter of knowing. That's what Nan Sen is saying. So just a couple specifics about this in terms of our practice, some things you might want to try in terms of this, is I find that it is really important just to make the intention to do the practice. If you have an intention to sit 3 times a week or once a week or whatever it is, to make that intention and just to do it. Just to do that. Just to give yourself to that. Give yourself to maybe the practice of meditation. Or give yourself to exploring generosity. Not worrying about the details, but just exploring it. To actually do it. Because there can be this again, as I was saying, this problem of being frozen by our questions. Being frozen about needing to know. And I think there's a place for questions, but not when they freeze us. And then we'll get more of the sense of following this path. This is something that's been very important for me. I know when I started to practice, I started in the Zen tradition, and it was still, this is a theme, I had this again, this gung-ho spirit. And I was going to do it. And one of the most powerful things about my practice as it has unfolded was having more of a sense of just following a path. It's made all the difference in the world. It's not me anymore. It's not even about me anymore. It's about following. And when we just do the practice, a lot of times we can start to get this taste of simply following. Recently, in the last maybe last few years, I started to do some Tibetan practices. I'd been exposed to some teachings from Mahamudra and Dzogchen teachings, and they were incredibly powerful and transformative teachings. And as a result of that, I became interested in some of the other practices in Tibetan Buddhism, and they were so different than Vipassana and Zen. Incredibly different than just sitting. You know, I'd spent all my life just sitting, just doing this sitting practice in various ways. And I told myself, you know, I'm just going to do these. I'm not going to worry about how they will function or why I'm even doing it. Teacher told me to do it, okay. And it's been incredibly liberating just to do that and not to worry how it's functioning. Yeah. And sometimes that's really what's needed in our practice, is just to do that in that sense. Because again, it's going to cultivate this following aspect, and again, as you notice, surrendering to something. Yeah. And I'm not saying that questions are not important or we shouldn't question. I'm just inviting you to bring something else online, something else into your practice, this quality of following. Okay, so a few more things. It's difficult in this point of the talk because there's so many things I want to say, but I have to figure out what's most important. So a few more things about what's needed in this following quality. And just a short poem by the Zen Master Ryokan. He says, define the Dharma. Define the Dharma. drift east and west, come and go, and trusting yourself to the waves. What particularly strikes me, and I'm sure you hear this, you know that last line, do you hear that last line? And trusting yourself to the waves. So following really requires some trust too. And trusting yourself. And trusting yourself to something more than our limited understanding. It requires that trust. And trust is a tricky thing in terms of this practice, because in order for us to begin to trust this practice, we need to do it, to get a taste of it, to see where it goes. Like the example I sometimes give is it's kind of like it's kind of the opposite. I don't have much trust in dishwashers. I don't know what it is. I think it's because the only time I've really been around a dishwasher for a long time is I used to work in a restaurant and used to wash dishes. But those are different dishwashers, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I'm over at someone's house, I'll ask them if they want their dishes in the dishwasher and I'll put them in there. But I don't really believe they're really going to come out that clean. I just don't buy it. I don't have trust. I cannot follow the dishwasher path. It's not there. And I think the problem is I can't entrust myself to the dishwasher because I haven't really experienced enough times to see how clean the plates come out. I don't trust that it's going to get rid of all this dirtiness in a way. Bring out this clean and pure plate. And as a result, you know, a lot of times if I'm at a friend's house for a long time, I'll stop using the dishwasher and I'll just hand wash them because I feel more comfortable doing that. That's what I'm gonna revert to, because that's what I know, and I know that it works. So practice is kind of similar. It really is. It's just like a dishwasher. if we haven't had a lot of experience with the meditation, if we don't really engage in it and give it a try and give it a taste to see that it really works, maybe in subtle ways, but significant ways, we're going to revert back to our old ways. We're naturally going to revert back to it. So a lot of times when I work with people, that can be such a question that comes up again and again, is how do I have a regular meditation practice? You know, I try, and then I forget about it, and then I try. And a lot of times it's coming to trust that process, but having a trust that's informed. And relying on that as a way to motivate your practice. Because when you really see the power of meditation, then it can be a lot easier to continue with. If you can see how this practice can unfold, it's much easier to stick with it. And then just one last analogy that I think might be helpful. And that I think this quality of following has this quality of receptivity to it that we can bring into our practice, which is so important. Again, that story I was saying is when I was looking for something, I was missing it. And a lot of times when we meditate or we follow this path, is what we need is this more this quality of receptivity, of really being open to what's there and allowing that to lead, simply just to witness what's going on in this receptive way. And one example I sometimes give of this is that when I was in college, I played in a jazz band. I played clarinet in a jazz band. And so I would practice a lot in terms of improvisation. And what I found is that the improvisation that I did was kind of the sweetest or the juiciest or was most fluid or most alive was when I was in this state where I was really kind of allowing myself to be moved by the other players, like by the drums, the upright bass, and the piano. And allowing something to come from there, this almost allowing something to come from that quality of receptivity, to respond from there. And I think that's when something really authentic came out, was more following, really listening, and then playing from that space. And I think a lot of times, that's what we're doing with this meditation, is that the more and more we meditate, the more and more we become aware and become receptive, there can be this deeper kind of response that can arise out of that. So again, that's following the Dharma. That's following this way. So may we all, you know, begin to follow this way, or continue to follow this way that leads to awakening. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments or anything folks want to share?
Practicing the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
but when the very few times you use the phrase refuge, and I've never heard it translated any other way. I don't know mm-hmm. what original Pali is,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, whether this is a common formula in other religions of the time or anything like that. But it sounds a little off or almost forced, you know, when you apply it to the things you applied it to tonight. So.
Mm-hmm.
What is added by calling these refuges? And clearly it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very fundamental notion, taking refuge.
Yeah.
And there's a ceremony of taking refuge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But why refuge?
Yeah. 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 It's a really good question. And literally that's what it means. You know, ti sarana. Sarana usually is refuge or shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 And, I mean, there was a tradition in the Buddhist time of kind of taking refuge in a person, in the sense of taking refuge in a ruler to get protection. So it was really this quality of protection. And I think there are things that come with this feeling of taking refuge. One is as I spoke about this a little bit last time, is that gaining a sense, I mean, I think this is what's so inspiring to me about this path or this practice, and that's getting a sense of, well, what is dangerous? That's what we want to think about. And what's dangerous are these other ways of being in the world. And I think a lot of times we come to practice because we see that the way we are in the world ain't working so good. Or we see that there's another possibility, another way of being in the world that's really quite radical and quite moving, not only for us but for other people. So for me, it's like, yeah, I want to take refuge in this because I know what happens with other ways of being in the world. So I'm not only talking individually, I'm talking collectively. You know, there's when the Buddha taught it, he said, you know, with suffering, there's two directions you can go in. You can go in a direction of more suffering, or you can go in a direction of awakening. And if you look at the world, that's a big direction of more suffering. And so taking refuge from that is taking refuge in a different way of being with suffering, in a way that leads to awakening. And I think when we get a sense of that, I think refuge is important, because to really sense in the suffering can be overwhelming. When it's not just, you know, and I'm talking about a global level too. A lot of times we're thinking about our own problems and things like that. But there's a lot of suffering in the world. And it's important, I think, if we're really going to take this practice on. This practice is about the end of suffering. It's not just about feeling good, it's about the end of suffering. And if that is a real intention, which is really what one is committing to in this practice, then you better have a really good refuge. You know what I mean? So I think that for me that's been really powerful, especially in difficult times, to come back and say, oh yeah, this is what I can really rest in is wakefulness. Or I can really rest in following this way. I don't know what else I'm going to do, but I can rest in this. And so I think in that sense it's really important. And it also, it has this quality of surrender. I'm not doing this, I'm surrendering to something. Surrendering, and I'm committing to something. Commitment. So to me, taking refuge really has this power to it. Because it reminds me also of, you said, the dangers. the dangers of suffering leading to suffering rather than it leading to awakening. Yeah. Does that give you some sense of the importance of refuge?
Well, we just got a dishwasher. And I think it makes a difference about who's washing the dishes. But I think the dishwasher gets the dishes really clean. I actually, one thing that was sort of evoked in my mind as you were talking, Brian, which I don't think you really mentioned, but I think is really central to taking refuge. And I mean, the Buddha talked about cultivating the wholesome and abandoning the unwholesome. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of renunciation or letting go or what we give up. And mm-hmm. I think in my own practice, I mean, as my own practice has deepened and matured over the years, I've become very aware of the necessity and the sort of freedom of that part of practice. And like, you just can't acquire and acquire and acquire without letting anything go.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as you sort of, you know, cultivate this practice and all that it entails in daily life, like, I think stuff does fall away. You know, relationships fall away that aren't
mm-hmm.
aren't supported by practice, and various activities and entertainments and, you know,
mm-hmm.
worldly things kind of fall away.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe that's kind of scary sometimes for
yeah.
people.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate that, because when we turn towards something, we're going to need to turn away from things,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. Mm-hmm. Is that what I'm hearing, in a sense? Is
Yeah. Just that happens.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah. And what a sweet thing to witness, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
A lot of stuff has gone to goodwill.
A lot of stuff.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I had a teacher say to me once, the Dharma will never desert you. And that has more meaning for me over the years. That was probably about 3 or 4 years ago that she said that. And it's like, what does that mean? I think I must have been talking about being fearful or trusting and different
mm-hmm.
things. And for her to say that, the Dharma will never desert you.
Mm.
And, you know, sure enough, that's true.
Mm. Nice.
So that's protection.
Yeah, has that same feel.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah.
Two quick things. One, going back to the beginning when you were talking about hearing these voices that give you the bad advice.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those voices are your own.
Mostly.
Yeah, very frequently they're your own.
Yes.
And the other thing was about the refuges. I'm in the practice of taking refuge every day. And I find, like, if there's a day when I've been rushing around and, oh, I didn't get to sit this morning, and I didn't do the refuges and I didn't do the precepts, and all of a sudden I'll feel just a little emptier. Because it's a very, I'm going to use one of your words, it's a very sweet practice. It really is.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for this evening.
Yeah.